Hi, I'm Brianna Contreras, Associate Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive.
Hello, I'm Peter Werwein. I'm Senior Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive.
Welcome to MHE Talks, Improving Patient Access, a new podcast series part of our Tuning Into the C-Suite podcast from Managed Healthcare Executive.
Patient access is a challenge that everyone in healthcare seems to have been talking about for decades. It's one of those big tent problems of American healthcare. A topic that takes in everything from practical problems like transportation to a doctor's appointment, or maybe in today's telehealth era, spotty Wi-Fi. There are also financial barriers to access, such as high out-of-pocket costs, and structural barriers, such as deeply rooted healthcare disparities and racism.
Our new podcast, MHE Talks, Improving Patient Access, will feature healthcare leaders and executives who are working to pull down the barriers to patient access. The goal is to have a lively, informative conversation about a foundational issue in American healthcare.
Well, hello, everybody. My name is Peter Werwein, and I am Senior Editor at Managed Healthcare Executive. And today I have the pleasure of speaking to Dennis Bordet. He's Professor Emeritus at Oregon Health and Sciences University. He started the MS Center there, and he's been treating MS patients for a couple of decades now. So he's, as I say, an old head in this space. And we're talking to him as part of a mini-series of podcasts we're doing about improving patient access. The full name is MHE Talks, Improving Patient Access. So thanks for taking the time today.
My pleasure.
So you've been seeing and treating MS for decades now, and I think it might be interesting for the viewers and listeners to just get your thoughts about how access issues have changed over the years. The first disease-modifying therapy came on the scene in 1993, and now there's over a dozen, and they have many different mechanisms of action. There are many, many more choices out there. But when you first started seeing multiple sclerosis patients, what were the access issues then, and how have they changed over these many years?
Well, I started treating people with MS in 1983, so a decade before the first disease-modifying therapy came on the market. And we really didn't have much in the way of access problems because we didn't have expensive drugs to be using. And actually, when I first started, MRI scans weren't available. So the first access issue we ran into was when the MRIs became available, justifying obtaining them in people either with MS or suspected MS. But I think as payers got used to having to cover that cost and we got more experience using them, that became less of a problem. So I would say in general, access was not an issue that we worried a whole lot about. Aside from occasionally needing to get permission for a coverage of an MRI scan. That did change dramatically in December of 1993 when the first MS disease-modifying therapy was released, beta-seron, which was the first recombinant beta-interferon. People were shocked at the annual price, which was $8,000 a year.
That would be a bargain.
Now, not only were payers shocked, but I think physicians were as well. There was a lot of discussion amongst neurologists whether was this drug really worth costing that much money. And then there were two more drugs released over the next 2 years: another interferon, Avonex, and then the non-interferon Copaxone or glimepiride acetate. So for a number of years, we had three drugs to choose from, and their prices were pretty stable, running $8,000 to $10,000 wholesale a year. And And payers were requiring that we document that they had relapsing MS, and there was some documentation, but it wasn't too onerous.
And what was, you are an expert in this area, and you were chair of the Department of Neurology, correct?
That's correct.
So how did you think about these hoops that you had to jump through and the cost effectiveness issue? Did you, were you skeptical about these drugs, and you saw the some of the documentation as sort of merited, or did you see this as standing in the way of patient access to needed therapy?
First off, I was convinced that these were beneficial, partly because we were one of the four sites on the trial that established the efficacy of Avonex. So we had pretty detailed knowledge of that drug. But I also looked carefully at the publications and knew the various key investigators for the trial for beta seron and for Copaxone. So I was convinced that the drugs had a positive effect on reducing relapses, which we were all convinced was part of the driving force.
So you were saying that you were a site and you saw these drugs as being important clinical developments. So did that make you angry at the payers who were requiring all this documentation?
Not really. The documentation was really pretty simple. They wanted a copy of our office note in which we stated that the patient had relapsing remitting MS, which was the indication for the drugs. And that's about it. We faxed those in. It's surprising that some insurers still use fax. I didn't really think it was that onerous, frankly. Mm-hmm. And nor did my staff.
So those were the early days when the first few drugs came on the market. Then what happened?
Well, then another interferon came on board, which they had data that they thought showed it was better than the other interferons. So they decided they would mark their drug up 50% in terms of the wholesale price. So they came in at about $15,000 instead of $10,000. And then the companies began raising their prices for the other drugs. And then in 2010, natalizumab came on the market. Then it came off the market for a while, but then it came back. And starting at that point, drug prices started going up for all of the drugs, even the older ones. Every year, it went up more and more. And coincident with that, more drugs, more expensive drugs, and payers began to require more documentation, and then ultimately started to coming up with tier systems that complicated the care of our patients and actually ended up taking more and more of our staff time with the documentation and appeals process.
So do you find it sort of some irony here that the understanding of the disease improves, or at least the therapeutic options improve, but sort of your role as a prescribing doctor gets increasingly complicated and maybe frustrated as the choices proliferate? Did you feel yourself on a seesaw here of clinical advancement, but bureaucratic ensnarement?
I think that's correct. From my standpoint as a physician, for 10 years, I had nothing really besides hope to offer patients. I saw many people becoming disabled, having their from the disease. So I knew about the ravages of MS, and we started having these drugs. And over time, it became quite apparent that we were having a positive effect on the disease course. But it also became apparent that we needed better drugs and more choices, because not everybody could had trouble with self-injections, or had problems with interferon side effects, or other side effects. So as a physician treating people with a complex illness, having more choices meant I had available to me a palette of drugs, in essence, that had different mechanisms, different side effect profiles, and that we should be able to customize therapy for most, if not all patients. So that's the wonder of it, the excitement of it. As an aside, I think one of the tremendous advances in therapeutics in neurology has been the MS therapeutics, because we now have data that indicates that we're decreasing the likelihood that people will become disabled long-term if we get therapy started early, particularly effective therapy. So we're really altering the natural history of the disease favorably. So that's very exciting. But the administrative burden of getting permission, even for tier one drugs, we have to get pre-authorization. The tier one drugs for a given insurance company might not be appropriate for a given patient, given the severity of their disease. And also, it's very frustrating to have every insurance company having their own rules and regulations that are often quite opaque or difficult to understand. So we have now in our clinic somebody who spends almost full time dealing with paperwork related to getting medication authorized, pre-authorized, appealing decisions to not cover things. There's issues now with regards to where people can get infusions, because some of the drugs are infusible, which again is driven by cost, because they want to use outpatient facilities or home-based facilities where there's no physician available to deal with side effects. So it's become very frustrating on the administrative end. I think the brunt of it ends up on our administrative staff. So we had an RN that was doing most of this work. It's expensive also. It's an unreimbursed expense. So it is frustrating to have both the ability to alter people's lives favorably with these drugs, and at the same time have to struggle to get them on the right medication or coverage for the right medication.
Yeah, and the success in MS stands in sort of stark contrast to, say, where we are with other neurological conditions such as Alzheimer's, where the therapeutic advances have been sort of not happened and we're still sort of confused about the mechanism of the disease. So, administrative burden and cost is the result of some payer policies. At the end of the day, though, do you think that patients have received the drugs that they should get in a timely fashion? I understand that it's hassle city and it adds yet more cost or our already hideously costly healthcare system. But if, in terms of people getting access to the care they need, have they received it with all these payer policies, or have you seen cases where people just, it didn't come in a timely way, or maybe they didn't get it at all? when I say it, I mean the medication that would best serve them and best address their MS?
I believe the patients that are seen by us at our MS center with varying degrees of difficulty end up getting the right medication. But we'll see a lot of patients who are initially receiving their care in the community by community neurologists who just do not have the infrastructure or the time to go to bat for the patients. There's a lot of anecdotal studies, not studies, but experiences with regards to that. So
do you think,
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Finish your thought. I apologize.
I think I was just reiterating that. I think with great effort, we're able to get patients on the right therapy. Some insurance companies, some payers are easier to work with than others with regards to that as well.
So do you think the problem is fundamentally the notion of step therapy? And do you have any ideas on how step therapy might be? Do we need to get rid of it root and branch? Or do you have some ideas about how it might be changed?
Well, my understanding is that the step therapy there are financial reasons for that.
Yes.
Has to do with contracts that are made between either the PBM or the insurance company and the wholesaler. So there is an understandable reason for cost control, and that's one way to do it. I think the frustrations, some of the frustrations could be dealt with. I think requiring, if you have a tier one, if you have three tier one MS drugs, requiring us to go through the paperwork of pre-authorization for one of those three drugs is a big waste of time. And yet we have to get pre-authorization and reauthorization once a year for the tier one drugs. And I think that's an administrative hassle that really it's not understandable because they're going to approve it. It's just, I don't understand that. I think the other problem is that there's a big controversy within the MS, amongst MS specialists regarding how early you go with a higher efficacy drug. So the if you look at treating 100 people with MS with the various drugs, it's clear that the infusibles, I don't know if that in general are more efficacious than the oral drugs, which are a bit more efficacious than the injectables. But they have more potential side effects. So there's a group of MS specialists that thinks everybody needs to go on a higher efficacy drug because that's how we're going to control the disease. We take a more nuanced approach because there are clearly people who will do well with safer, lower efficacy drugs long term. I'm often comfortable putting somebody on a tier one drug that's just three of the, typically it's one oral, one interferon, and one glutamine acetate. I'm typically comfortable with that initially as we follow the patient very carefully. But there are some patients that come in the door, get diagnosed, and based upon the characteristics of their MS, how many lesions do they have, how active has their MS been, we know that they're not going to do well unless they get on a high efficacy drug up front. And then we often have problems getting approval for that. So it would be good if there was a way to at least have some more easy flexibility for the subset of patients who meet certain criteria regarding disease activity. so that we don't have to step through two or three failures before we get access to the higher efficacy drugs.
And just to be clear, the higher efficacy drugs are the monoclonal antibody drugs. That's what you're referring to?
Yes. I think the other one that would be put in that category is cladribine, which is not a monoclonal, but it's tablets. We don't use that drug because it ablates lymphocytes and long-term, and it's only approved for two dose sequencing, and it's not clear what you're going to do with those patients long-term. So we have safety concerns about that. All the others are monoclonals.
So what you suggest seems, I do mean to be glib. It sounds so rational. And it seems like, MS care and is very sophisticated, it strikes me. And that one could set up a system whereby a patient with a certain number of lesions, and the lesions look like such and such, according to, some learned society of MS specialists, and that those patients wouldn't have to be put on the lower tier drugs, that they could move, they could sort of pass go in the tiered system and be put on in most cases on a monoclonal antibody. Why hasn't reason won out here? I mean, it just seems like it's a fixable problem, that's all.
It's a good question, don't know. I'm talking to colleagues around the country, there's a lot of regional differences. I mean, I know people in the South seem to be able to use whatever they want to use, but up here in the Northwest, insurance carriers are more difficult.
Yeah.
Not difficult, more restrictive. We tried to work with one of the major in carriers. I had a meeting with the pharmacists in charge of the special pharmacy program, which included MS, about this particular problem that I just raised. That is, I'm happy with your tier one drugs for the average MS patient, but it's a problem for this subgroup that I mentioned, that really we should be able to go directly to a higher efficacy drug. And she agreed. We actually did a little experiment where they allowed us to use any tier one that we wanted without pre-authorization,
which is one problem that you suggested,
right? And they would, because the concern was, well, if we just open the floodgates, doctors will use the higher efficacy drugs right away. It worked sort of well, except that there were just communication problems within the insurance company, where the screeners didn't know about this deal. And
right.
So I just think there's, at least in our area, there's very little communication with the physicians. They set up their tier system based on pharmacist review of the literature. I was the first time I had talked to this pharmacist. I was the first neurologist that knew about MS that had talked with her about. So I think there's very, again, in our area, there's just very little communication with physicians. The irony, one of the ironies is that the drug companies and the biotech companies have, all these representatives that meet with the physicians. They're not, they're pretty restricted in what they can do at an academic center. But so you have, they build relationships uh, for, for reasons that are obvious. Insurance companies don't do that. We have terrible, terrible relationships with the insurance company because of all the administrative hassles I've been alluded to. And in fact, we should be having a partnership with them, because I think most physicians believe in helping control costs. We understand that that's a problem. We just would like to be more engaged by the insurance companies rather than having these decisions made that perhaps aren't nearly as logical as they think they are.
It's interesting how it, you know, by virtue of sales, there's a lot of communications between drug companies and physicians because, you know, one side has a strong motivation for such communication. But maybe the insurers, I haven't thought about this, but maybe insurers just don't have that big an incentive, you know. Otherwise, perhaps it would occur. So you did have a bit of a pilot project, in some sense a pilot project whereby this subset of patients would not necessarily be put on tier one drugs. I mean, did that actually happen, or was this sort of, did it end up getting gummed up and you, it never really fully executed?
It didn't really happen.
Okay.
We did something similar. Now this is with our one of the major CCOs for Medicaid. Because now this is a different situation, but they were interested in partnering with us to help control costs, because they had some drugs that they paid much less for. There was also this whole issue of the off-label use of the monoclonal rituximab in place of ocrelizumab, because there's a huge cost differential. So we entered into a relationship with this one CCO to manage all of their 400 or so MS patients with regards to their medications, to try to make it more rational and streamlined. And that's continued. And that I think has been beneficial. In part because we found people that were on drugs that actually didn't have MS, and people who had carried the diagnosis but for various reasons hadn't been started on a drug, or they'd started on something they didn't tolerate and they stopped. So that system worked well.
Interesting. Interesting. So you got hired as sort of an MS experts
They provided some a little bit of FTE support for a neurologist and a nurse practitioner to manage this program.
Well, it sort of speaks to the question of bringing in some sense medical and MS expertise to coverage issues, which is, you know, sort of maybe lies at the heart of the problem that we've been discussing. Just one point of information that I want to clarify. I'm looking at the clock here and we're winding down. This subgroup that you've referenced, who have MS of a type that would suggest that they move to higher efficacy and higher cost drugs more or less right away, as opposed to being on a tier one drug. How large a group of patients, what proportion of patient of MS patients is that sub?
Of the newly diagnosed?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether it's a sliver or a fat chunk of, fat piece of pie.
Well, if you ask me, my guess is these 20% or so.
Right.
Now I alluded to this already. There is a group of neurologists that thinks everybody should go on the high efficacy therapy to begin with.
But you're not in that group.
No, but I'm not alone. But it's because there's this balance. Actually, the more higher efficacy drugs have more serious side effects, maybe at a low rate. But if I have a patient that says, I want to be on the safest drug possible, I put them on one of the original injectables, because this, the safety data on long-term safety data is pretty incredible for those drugs. But if you were going to do something, you'd put together, as you alluded to, either a national or a regional group of experts to come up with what the criteria would be. Because I'm sure the concern of the insurance company would be, if we don't have any controls, then people are going to use whatever they want, and we won't be able to control costs by having a limited, limited formulary or restricted formulary.
And of course, with the dozen or so drugs, and as you said initially, these were drugs that now seem like a pittance, $8,000 a year. Now they're close to $83,000 or $100,000 a year. So if without some sort of some attention to cost, it would just, the care gets costly, the insurance premiums go up, but, the whole cycle sort of takes off.
Thanks for listening, and keep an eye out for the next episode of the MHE Talks Improving Patient Access podcast series. Episodes to this podcast can be found on our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.